Greetings and welcome to Experiencing the Word, a Bible study ministry of Atonement Lutheran Church in Fargo, North Dakota. My name is Paul Cross, and I will be your guide through the Bible as we seek to understand God's plan for our lives and to learn life lessons from the pages of Scripture. In this season of study, we will focus our attention on Genesis, the first book of the Bible, the book of beginnings. If you would like to attend one of our studies, we meet at Atonement Lutheran, located at 4601 South University Drive here in Fargo. We meet on Wednesday nights at 6:30. But for now, join us in this recording of a live session of Experiencing the Word. Father, thank you for another night around your Word. We ask that you would direct and guide our conversation. Lord, as we put a bow on the life of Abraham, at least in the New Testament, the Old Testament, we ask now that you would direct and guide our conversation tonight. Lord, be in this place so that we might grow and learn from your word. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, I tell you what, tonight, we'll see how far we get. There are basically two things that are left undone. One is the latter part of Abraham's life, sort of everything up to what we've come thus far. Where we've come thus far is up to the promise of Isaac, so that promised child. Now we'll be looking at Abraham's life after the promised child, and what happens is this, is it's surprisingly brief. That's the crazy thing. You look at this and it's practically, when you compare it to all the other things that are entailed that we've gone through up to this point, there are a couple little episodes that are here and there, but the biggest and most significant one, of course, is the sacrifice of Isaac, which is probably, I'd have to say, the most disturbing episode in the Bible. And we'll look at that tonight. I would have to say that there's not much more disturbing than the sacrifice of Isaac, and we'll talk about that a little bit. Then the other thing that remains to be done with regard to Abraham, and I won't necessarily do it with other things, and that's this. Abraham in the New Testament. Of course, Abraham lives millennia, before the New Testament. At least 1,800 years, probably 2,100 years before the New Testament. But for some reason, Abraham's got staying power. And we'll see Abraham mentioned significantly in the New Testament. And there's a lot that we can learn about what the New Testament has to say about Abraham. We'll certainly won't get that far tonight. I don't know how far we'll get tonight. But they're primarily the following episodes that we're going to be looking at. The first one is this, is we're going to meet another individual who falls for the line, "She's my sister." Remember the "She's my sister" episode in Egypt? Well, if it was good enough to work, I had a preaching professor that said to me, "Paul, if the sermon was good enough to preach once, it's good enough to preach twice. Just try to remember which congregation you preached it to." Probably a good idea. The second episode of "She's My Sister" is a little bit different. The characters are different. The characters are Philistines this time instead of Egyptians. The next episode that comes along is the actual birth of Isaac and the banishment of Hagar and Ishmael. Then finally we have the sacrifice of Isaac, and last but not least, the death of Sarah and then the death of Abraham. And so we'll try to get as much of that as we can tonight. And I think that you'll find that it's Well, I'll let you tell me what you think it's like. So let's turn our Bibles, if you would, to Genesis chapter 20. Genesis chapter 20. Now see, they keep pushing this thing further back, and you keep going further back. So you know what I'm going to do? Bring it to here. Do you know how to keep it up there, don't you? By going and getting your friends and having them fill in these people. pews up here. Then you can be safe back there. Hi, Becky. I didn't mention you by name, though. Especially my sister.
Your wife would have told you she had seen it.
Okay, let's crank this up. Chapter 20. Anybody feel like reading?
I will. How long will we read?
You're a quick learner, aren't you? Huh? Waiting all week to, yeah, quick study. Okay, read, sir.
Okay, just a second. I'm all right. Yeah, that will be all. I'm all right. Verse one. Now Abraham moved on from there into the region of Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur. For a while, he stayed in Gerar, and there Abraham said of his wife Sarah, "She's my sister."
There we go again.
Then
Abimelech. Let me stop here just for a quick second. Just a little bit about Abimelech. You're going to run into a number of Abimelechs in the Bible. At least three. There are at least three Abimelechs in the Bible, and each of them have their. Well, two of them are Philistines. Some have suggested that they're the same person, but I don't think so. There's an Abimelech with the episode with regard to Abraham, and there's an Abimelech with a very similar episode with regard to Isaac, his son. And then there is an Abimelech who you find in the book of Judges. But the word Abimelech means, my father is king. My father is king. And what it might mean is it might be like Pharaoh. Remember Pharaoh? You never say Pharaoh, you always say Pharaoh. You got to have that little southern contempt that goes in it a little bit. You know, they say it right in the south, Pharaoh. You got to have that little contempt there. It may be a title, because it may be the title that the Philistines gave to their king, Abimelech. Just to kind of let you know that. So Ab, it means father, and Melech is king, like Burger Melech. You've been to the new Burger Melech over here? Who's been to the new Burger King? Of course you've been to the new Burger Melech. Absolutely. Settle down. A little early for that. Read on.
Then Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent for Sarah and took her.
No mind.
But God came to Abimelech.
Abimelech, yeah.
And in a dream one night, and said to him, "You are as good as dead."
Wow, that'll get your attention.
Yeah, because of the woman you have taken. She's a married woman.
Ah!
Now Abimelech had not gone near her. Mm-hmm. So he said, "Lord, will you destroy an innocent nation? Did he not say to me, 'She's my sister'? Mm-hmm. Didn't she also say, 'He's my brother'? Mm-hmm. I've done this with a clear conscience and clean hands."
Yes.
Then God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know you did this with a clear conscience. And so I have kept you from sinning against me. That is why I did not let you touch her. Now, return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not return her, you may be sure that you and all yours will die."
Okay. I've said to you before, where are you and how did you get there is an important question in the Bible. Where is Abraham now? Abraham is dangerously close to prime real estate. And anytime you get dangerously close to prime real estate, you get dangerously close to people who have been living there for a bit of time. And the longer somebody has been living in a place in a bit of time, the more powerful they are. Now, the people that have been living here for quite some time, maybe not quite some time, there's some discussion as to how long these folks actually had lived there. Critical scholars say that's not likely, but I disagree with them. We're dealing with the Philistines. Now, this is kind of, I shouldn't say kind of, this is in fact our first introduction to our friends, the Philistines. Now, those of you who have read your Bibles know the Philistines from where? David and Goliath, absolutely. The Philistines are Israel's chief adversary. You will recall that Goliath is sort of the champion of the Philistine army. Now, if you were living in Great Britain and you were to call somebody a Philistine, that would be a very unkind thing to say about them. You would be saying, it's kind of our equivalent of redneck. You wouldn't want to call somebody a redneck because redneck is a very unkind thing to say about them. A redneck is somebody who's uncouth, unlearned, and so forth, correct? And that's what you would say about that. That would be the equivalent of a Philistine if you were in Great Britain. But it's just the opposite in the Bible. The Philistines were a highly advanced culture. They're the ones who invented the alphabet, by the way. And if you don't think that that's a significant invention, try reading hieroglyphics. Try reading pictographs. Try reading cuneiform. Because prior to the alphabet, this is how people had written communication. It's incredibly complex, a pictograph. That means when you're kind of trying to draw out what you're trying to say. Or cuneiform is you're trying to use symbols to show what you're trying to say. Hieroglyphics. Cuneiform is where you're using a series of the same looking little triangles, but the way you're putting them together, that's how you make certain sounds. Again, incredibly difficult way to read. But the Philistines, well, it was actually the Phoenicians, which is sort of the parent company of the Philistines, they were the ones who figured out the alphabet. And the alphabet that we have today, where you have A, B, C, D, E, F, G, like that, guess what? They're the ones that figured it out. I remember in 1960, there was an encyclopedia salesman that came by our parents' house and sold us a copy of the World Book Encyclopedia. And as a young person, this is going to sound horribly geeky, but we didn't have video games back then. And I wasn't skilled at anything, and so I read the World Book Encyclopedia, if you can imagine such a thing. It only came in handy telling some of it once. I was in the British Museum. I was running from God. I was standing by the Magna Carta, and I finally ran into an American woman. It had been several weeks since I ran into an American, and she was an older woman. I got chatting with her, and I started talking with her about this and that and the importance of the Magna Carta. She says, well, that's fascinating. How did you know all that? She says, well, this is going to sound terribly geeky, but when I was a 10-year-old boy, I read the World Book Encyclopedia. And she stopped there and said, would you mind waiting here for a second? And so I waited there and waited there and waited there. And finally, she came back with her husband. And she said, would you mind repeating to my husband what you just repeated to me? And I said, yes. Do you know what? You got it. He was the editor of the World Book Encyclopedia. How crazy is that? How nuts is that? So that was pretty little strange thing. But in the World Book Encyclopedia, in the 1960 edition, at the beginning of each section, they had the various differentiated alphabets, beginning with the Phoenician one or the ones the Philistines used. Incredible technology. They also were a seafaring people. They pretty much controlled the coastland of the entire Mediterranean. And finally, they got to the Eastern Mediterranean, and so they set up camp there. They didn't go inland very far. They would primarily just use the coastland, use the coastal plain. Oftentimes, the coastal plain's a good place for agriculture because what you'll get is you will get the sea breezes bringing in a little bit of rain clouds, get the moisture evaporation off the Mediterranean, turns into clouds, it comes on land, it condenses, and then it rains right there in that coastal plain. So it's not a bad place to have crops. And also, they additionally, because they traveled extensively, they were able to pick up technology frequently. And they got, as to actually when they became an iron-using people, is in somewhat of a dispute, not a big one, but they were among the first to start using iron. So, I mean, they really had all the cool technology. So these were not ignorant people. These weren't a bunch of knuckle-dragging redneck type people that you might think about and so forth, or uncouth or whatever. These were highly intelligent people. They happened to be pagans. They happened to worship their own set of gods. They did not worship the same set of gods that, say, the Canaanites worship. The Canaanites had their set of gods that they worshiped. They had their own set of gods that they worshiped. So they were different than the Canaanites. And as a result of having all this technological and intellectual and cultural advantage, they became Israel's chief enemy. And what we have here is we have Abraham getting closer and closer and closer to interacting with the Philistines. Now, Abraham's already interacted with Sodom and Gomorrah, right? We're going to see later on that he has interacted with the Canaanites. Okay. Now he's starting to interact with the Philistines, which is kind of interesting because these are all historical enemies of Israel. And you say to yourself, why is it that he's able to interact with these people? And basically, they respect him. They respect him tremendously. And there's an interesting life lesson that we can learn from this. In his life, Abraham, first of all, looked to God. He looked to God and he looked to live by his covenant with God. He wasn't always successful at it. He oftentimes was boneheaded at it. But that was his goal, was to try to do this. Abraham also had the covenant that not only was he going to get land and not only was he going to get offspring, but does anybody remember what the third one was? Blessing. That he was not just going to be blessed, but he was blessed to be a blessing. So in his world, his purpose was to bless those people around him. Now, it was said about Abraham Lincoln that he didn't get along well with a lot of the people in his cabinet. He was a firm believer in keep your friends close, your enemies closer. And he really did that because he had a lot of enemies. And I'm not talking about in the South. Abraham Lincoln had a lot of enemies in the North, a lot of them. And when finally the Union Army defeated secured the surrender of Lee at Appomattox, Lincoln, here's where his surrender terms. You know the surrender terms that Lincoln gave to Grant? Officers could keep their sidearm and their sword and their horse if they could prove that it was theirs, their horse or their mule, if they could prove that it was theirs. Enlisted personnel needed to turn in any military firearm and go home. Those were the terms of the surrender of the Civil War. Seriously, that was it. It was written on the back of like a paper bag. I mean, it was so simple. Now, this infuriated a lot of the Union brass. And it was said one time that in a meeting shortly after this, before he was assassinated, one of the generals just burst out and says, "Mr. Lincoln, these people are your enemies. You're supposed to destroy your enemies." To which Lincoln is supposed to have replied, "I destroy my enemies when I make them my friends." And oftentimes, I think here's a lesson that we could learn as Christians. Particularly in an ever-increasing hostile world, a world that's hostile to Christianity, and you know, do I have to preach that? I mean, I think we live in a world that, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious. We have to remember that as children of Abraham, we are blessed to be a blessing. And that in our lives, we need to work to be a blessing, particularly with whom those people, whom we most vehemently, or vehemently, depending on how you want to pronounce that, disagree with. And Abraham, you can extrapolate that he lived that way. Because everywhere he went, he wasn't in fear of being annihilated, even though he worshipped way different than everybody else did. But everybody could tell that he was blessed and he was there to be a blessing to others. Now, that didn't mean there weren't conflicts. But it is interesting to see how Abraham interacted with those people who truly are the godless pagans, so to speak. Okay. Life lesson for us. We're blessed to be a blessing. Read on.
Early the next morning, Abimelech summoned all his officials, and when he told them all that had happened, they were very much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham in, and he said, "What have you done to us? How have I wronged you that you have brought such great guilt upon me and my kingdom? You have done things to me that should not be done." And Abimelech asked Abraham, "What was your reason for doing this?" Abraham replied, "I said to myself, there is surely no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife."
Okay, now stop here just for a second. Again, this goes to the thing, the fear of people of faith often have towards people who don't have faith. Surely there is no fear of God in this place, and they're all going to kill me. Well, if you're in the blessing business, you may not have to worry about that. Read on.
"Besides, she really is my sister."
Be prepared to go ooh for a second here. Get you on the count of three. One, two, three. Ooh, that's good. Come on. One, two, three. Ooh. Okay, get ready. Are you ready to go? Okay, read on.
"The daughter of my father, though not of my mother, and she became my wife.
Ooh.
And when God had me wander from my father's household, I said to her, 'This is how you can show your love to me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother.'"
Okay. Now, let me stop here for a second. This is kind of an interesting point to make, because if we get that far tonight, I hope we will, we're going to take a look at Abraham's three wives. His first wife, and this is a... This indicates sort of the tribal and clannish nature and familial nature of Abraham's world. He's married to his half-sister, okay? Now, in our culture, that's a fairly disgusting sort of concept. We think, goodness gracious sakes alive, that's a pretty awful thing. But apparently, it wasn't such an odd thing for them. We will see later on that it seems to be very important to Abraham that when looking for a daughter-in-law for his son Isaac, he wants to go fishing in the same pool again. He wants to send a servant back to go and find a suitable wife among his kinspeople. Because not kinsmen, because you wouldn't do that. But I mean, basically, somebody in the family. That's what he's looking for. He's looking for a very tight-knit sort of group of people right here. And how much tighter can you get than having your sister as your spouse or your brother as your spouse? That's pretty tight-knit, and thank you very much. I'm not interested in that. But I'd like to cast the net a little bit broader than that. So that's wife number one. Wife number two, anybody remember where she was from? Egypt. Okay. And again, you get this sense of her being from Egypt as being somewhat exotic, somewhat interesting in that regard, somewhat different. Now, it's interesting when we read through the Old Testament, for some reason, in spite of the many bans on marrying this person or marrying that person, it seemed to be okay to intermarry with the Egyptians. That didn't seem to be a problem, because you'll see that coming up repeatedly. And that seems to be okay. Intermarrying with Canaanites, not a good thing. Intermarrying with Egyptians, that seemed to be okay. What's up with that? I don't know. But she's an Egyptian. But there's wife number three. So we've got Sarah, we've got Hagar, and wife number three, we'll get to her. And her background's a little bit more of a question mark with regard to this. So we'll talk a little bit about that later. So keep going on. You're doing a great job.
"Then Abimelech brought sheep and cattle and male and female slaves and gave them to Abraham. And he returned Sarah, his wife, to him. And Abimelech said, 'My land is before you. Live wherever you like.' To Sarah he said, 'I am giving your brother 1,000 shekels of silver. This is to cover the offense against you before all who are with you. You are completely vindicated.' Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, his wife, and his slave girls, so they could have children again. For For the Lord had closed up every womb he had of Abimelech's household because of Abraham's wife Sarah.
Okay, now, curious thing here. Sarah, of course, is not having children, but apparently neither were any of Abimelech's folks having children as well. What's interesting is this kind of indicates that apparently this arrangement was not a short-term thing. Because, I mean, we tend to think about things happening boom, 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 just like that. Because we're used to seeing things in the movies. We're used to seeing things on TV where things happen instantaneously. Well, again, the Bible's only kind of hitting the high parts here. We need to see that there are probably several months that this episode was going on. And also, take a look at this. Abraham was, what was one of the characteristics, the W characteristic I said about Abraham? Anybody remember the W characteristic? Exactly. Wealthy. He was stinking rich. And guess what? When he leaves Abimelech, he's stinking richer. He's richer. He's got more stuff. He's got sheep and shekels. And not a bad deal. I'll take sheep and shekels anytime. Alex, I'll take sheep and shekels for 100, 200. Did you see what happened on Jeopardy the other day? This is amazing. Not only did nobody get the final Jeopardy answer, they all bet everything, which meant they couldn't come back. Nobody got to come back. And it was, I thought, an easy question, but I don't know, neither, but whatever. Be that as it may. Nevertheless, so we have couple things also in this episode I want you to see. God intended to keep Abimelech from sinning. God did not want Abimelech to sin, so he sent through a dream, and so there was that intention. Notice that that sin would have been against God, not so much Abraham and Sarah. Sin would have been violating God's unilateral covenant with Abraham. So it's important for us to see that God's intention is not for people to sin. The second thing is that here, Abraham is called a prophet, which again, we don't think of Abraham as a prophet. We tend to think of him more as sort of the patriarch of the family. But nevertheless, we are introduced now to the Philistines. They seem to be a pretty decent lot for who they are for the time being. But that'll change quickly, believe me. What happens next? What does happen next is the promise. As I said, things change really, really quickly. Who would like to read? Let's get somebody different here. Verse 1 of chapter 21.
Somebody?
I will.
Okay. Read, sister.
The Lord visited Sarah as he had said, mm-hmm. and the Lord did to Sarah as he had promised. Mm-hmm. And Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the time of which God had spoken to him.
Now, I want to highlight the Lord, the Lord, the Lord. This is God's doing. This is miraculous. Read on, sister.
Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, mm-hmm. as God had commanded. Mm-hmm. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh over me. And she said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age.
Okay, let's just stop here just for a brief second. We see a couple things here. The first thing we see is that God is the primary actor here. That God is the one that brought this this incredible miracle about, and so that we want to focus on God's doing in this particular passage. It's the only way it could happen, because Sarah was what, 90 years old, something like that? Sarah was old, and as we learned from last time, it clearly said that she is beyond menopause. It's beyond the way of women for her. So this is clearly a miracle, and that's emphasizing it again. Then the next part I want us to highlight here is the fact that Abraham goes through with the process of circumcision. You will recall that in chapter 17, all the males got the clippity-clip at that time, including Ishmael, who, by the way, is about 13, 14 years old at this time. It's important for us to keep that in mind. So Ishmael is there, and so now Isaac gets the circumcision, the clippity-clip, and off they go. Off they go. So Abraham has remembered to keep that covenant. So that's all good. Things are starting to go great. This is a wonderful thing. So everything's fabulous. The promise is great. We can sort of see the titles sort of starting to roll in the background. We're coming to the end of the story, right? No. No. Two very ugly things happen right now. Very, very ugly things happen. Things that are so ugly, you have to ask yourself, why would God not allow this, why would God seem to prefer that this happen? Why would God seem to have his hand in this happening? And this bugs us. Maybe it just bugs me. Maybe you aren't bugged by some of this. Because the first thing that happens, well, let's see what the first thing that happens is. Let's take a look. Keep reading. You're doing a wonderful job.
And the child grew and was weaned. Mm-hmm. And Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned.
So he's probably 3, 4, something like that. Something like that. I don't know when they stopped breastfeeding kids back in the ancient Near East. Some cultures go a long time. Some cultures don't. But it's at least sometime that I'm thinking maybe 2, 3, something like that. I know people might think, really? Well, there are some cultures, 7, 8. That's, I know it sounds strange, but don't shake your head at me. Are you forcing me to quote chapter and verse and get graphic? Oh, thank you. No. I know there. We're talking, but neither does marrying one's sister sound reasonable either. I was going to say, so let's not go crazy with this. All right. In any case, so anyway, he's weaned. All right. Read on.
But Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, laughing. So she said to Abraham, cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of the slave woman shall not be heir with my son Isaac.
Now, I got to stop here for a second here. I'm going to have to crank on Sarah a little bit here. First of all, didn't she laugh too? I mean, is laughing at this thing such a preposterous thing? Wasn't she one that God caught laughing? And number two, she does seem to play the slave card quite a bit. She says over and over again, it's like, I mean, she's kind of rubbing it in Hagar's face. Well, wait a minute, whose idea was this? It was her idea. But nevertheless, we have a woman that's, you know, absolutely, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, or one that's upset at you, or one that you forgot to bring the eggs home with, or forgot to get her coffee in the morning. So nevertheless, she's pretty upset right now, so you better watch out. So keep reading.
And the thing was very displeasing to Abraham on account of his son. But God said to Abraham, be not displeased because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Mm-hmm. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you. For through Isaac shall your offspring be named. And I will make a nation of the son of the slave woman also, because he is your offspring. Mm-hmm. So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water and gave it to Hagar, putting it on her shoulder along with the child, and sent her away. And she departed and wandered in the wilderness of
Beersheba. Okay. Beersheba is a place that's sort of towards the south in the Negev wilderness, towards Egypt. It's a well. Beer means well. And Sheba means either covenant or oath or seven. So I always remembered this by, you know, go get me a 7-pack. I thought it was funnier. It takes a little while. Yeah, go get me a 7-pack. It takes a little bit of time. It's slow on the uptake there, but nevertheless. Now, Beersheba. So this is a place that you could visit today if you so chose to. Nevertheless, he sends her out this way. Now, Abraham's kind of sad about this, but nevertheless, out she and he go. Okay, keep going.
When the water in the skin was gone, she put the child under one of the bushes. Then she went and sat down opposite him a good way off, about the distance of a bow shot. For she said, let me not look at the death of the child.
You know, when you read this, you think like this kid's like four. But he's 14, okay? All right, read on.
And as she sat opposite him, she lifted up her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the boy, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. Up, lift up the boy, and hold him fast to your hand, for I will make him into a great nation. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. And God was with the boy, and he grew up. He lived in the wilderness and became an expert with the bow. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt.
Okay, so Mama goes back to where she's from and says, let's go get you one of them Egyptian gals to marry. Okay, and so you'll be a lot happier with one of them Egyptian gals to marry. And so that's what she does. She goes and says, we're going to do this. Now, I'll come back to this later. We will come back to this. But we get the picture. It's kind of harsh, though, wouldn't you say? It's pretty harsh to send this poor kid out there. But God watches over him. God's got his back. God's really watching over everything here. God's watching over Hagar. God's watching over Ishmael. God's taking care of this. But it does seem harsh and bothersome to us. I mean, it doesn't make us really want to come up and give Sarah a big hug or anything like that. Or it kind of makes us say, Abraham, come on, stand up to your wife for crying out loud. But God says, no, this is how it's got to be. You listen to what she's got to say. We'll get this all fixed. So, nevertheless, we have this. What comes next? We won't read item by item, line upon line, precept upon precept, because we might be here. Well, let's see here. Will we read this? Yeah, let's read this. Might as well. Hey, you're doing a great job. You want to keep going?
Sure.
More Philistine stuff.
At that time, Abimelech.
Wow. Yeah, I got it.
Okay.
You can pronounce it however you want to.
And Phicol?
Phicol.
The commander of his army said to Abraham.
Wasn't that Ford's electronic company, Phicol? Philco. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Now there is a joke that really dates me, really, as I said. You have to be ancient of days to appreciate that one. Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
God is with you in all that you do. Now, therefore, swear to me.
I used to see Philco television sets. Remember, they made Philco made that little Ford Oval on a television set. What was up with that? Go ahead. I'm sorry. Well, not really sorry, but as I said, I just, okay. There's not, I don't get to tell that joke very often. About once every 6, 7, 8 years when I'm finally teaching on this do I get to tell that joke. And, you know, you need a much older audience each time. So, okay. Read on.
God is with you in all that you do. Now, therefore, swear to me here by God that you will not deal falsely with me or with my descendants or with my trust. Posterity, but as I have dealt kindly with you, you will deal with me and with the land where you have suffered. And Abraham said, I will swear.
Okay, so basically, Abimelech and Philco, or whatever his name is, they see this and they say, holy cats, look at this guy. He just seems to live a life of charm and grace. We want to be on this guy's best side. We want to make sure that he is doing well for us, because if he does well for us, things are going to go good for us. If he doesn't do well for us, well, who knows what's going to happen to us? So let's make a deal with this guy. Let's make sure that we're on the smooth side of him and not on the tough side of him. So they smooth the deal with Abraham, and Abraham says, sure, fine, we'll do this. So let's see what happens with the rest of the deal here, okay?
When Abraham reproved Amalek about a well of water that Amalek's servants had seized,
yes.
Amalek said, I do not know who has done this thing. You did not tell me, and I have not heard of it until today.
Yeah, sure, pal.
So Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Amalek, and the two men made a covenant. Abraham set 7 ewe lambs on the flock apart. And Amalek said to Abraham, "What is the meaning of these 7 ewe lambs that you have set apart?" He said, "These 7 ewe lambs you will take from my hand, that this may be a witness for me that I dug this well."
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, that place was called Beersheba.
Or 7.
Yes. Because they're both of them swore an oath,
mm-hmm.
so that they made a covenant at Beersheba. Then Amalek and Phicol, the commander of his army, rose up and returned to the land of the Philistines. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba and called there on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham suffered many days in the land of the Philistines.
Okay, so Abraham's hanging out in the land of the Philistines. Now, what's the whole purpose of this episode here? Well, the purpose of this episode here is to kind of establish the background of Beersheba. Beersheba is going to be an extremely important place in the history of Israel. An extremely important place in the history of Israel. But what's being established is who owns this? Who's got the property rights to this? Or whose territory is this? Because this is going to come in dispute. Why is it going to come in dispute? What is it? It's a well. It's about water rights, for crying out loud. You've never heard about people disputing about water rights before, have you? I'm sure that doesn't happen up here. Has that ever happened up here in North Dakota? Never. As I said, North Dakotans would never think about disputing about water rights. Never think about such a thing. Well, maybe so. Just mineral rights. Well, then there's that. Yes, exactly. So there's this dispute about this, but basically Abraham says, okay, I will take the first loss. The first loss was the well that I dug. I'll take that one. But we're going to be clear from this point on. From this point on, here are 7 sheepsies, okay? Here are the 7 sheepsies, and you get the 7 sheepsies, okay? And then we're going to have a covenant, and we're going to cut this covenant. And we're going to have a little feast here. We're going to probably chow down on a couple of the sheepsies just because they make for good barbecue. Did you know that they sell sheep burgers in this town? You can get a sheep burger at one of your favorite restaurants. At Doolittle's, did you know, you can get a lammy burger. Cute little furry lammies, they chop them up and make hamburgers out of them. Imagine that. They're not that bad. No, of course not. Anyway, so they have this, but the purpose of this is to establish this. Now, again, you see this unusual relationship, because the Philistines are going to be, bad to the bone when it comes to the future of Israel. And yet, they have utmost respect for Abraham. Utmost respect for Abraham. So we see that happening here. Okay. Any questions, or just pretty much simple stuff, and we got on to the hard stuff right now.
Are there very many other covenants besides ones God made that are of importance that we hear about?
Not that we hear about per se. This one is one that God does not make. This is obviously made by Abraham and others. In our lesson on covenants, you will recall that there are 4 primary covenants in the Old Testament. There's the covenant that God makes with Noah. There's the covenant that God makes with Abraham. There's the covenant that God makes with Moses, and the covenant that God makes with David. Those are the 4 big ones. In that discussion, we talked about how covenants were very common in the ancient Near East. Do you recall me talking about cuneiform tablets, those little funny-looking triangle things, trying to write with those triangle things? We've discovered many of those cuneiform tablets, and what many of them are covenants that are made between people. Lots of stuff like that, exactly. Insurance policies, whatever you want to call them. Not insurance policies like we know insurance policies, but agreements, and basically it was written down. This is how you kept things clear between different parties. people are people, for crying out loud. I mean, they're not any different then as they are now. They have the same ways of looking at the world. We just sort of lack technology. That's pretty much the major difference. But in terms of how they interacted with each other, in terms of their emotions, in terms of their thought patterns, they're very similar. I mean, we tend to think of ancient people as being particularly ignorant. Well, they're not. By any stretch of the imagination were they particularly ignorant. They figured out how to make beer. Well, I mean, I joke about that. But think about this. Beer has been around for 5,000 years. That's 3,000. No. Longer than that. It's like 5,000 BC is when beer started. Have you ever been to a brewery? Okay, I know you're Norwegians and don't want to admit it in church, I know. But I mean, I've been to plenty of them, and I love going to brewery tours. I think, do you know the chemistry that's involved in making beer? I mean, it's unbelievably sophisticated. It's not simple fermentation. It's not. I mean, you got to cook stuff, you got to do this, you got to do that, then you ferment it, then you put it in this and that. I mean, you got to take some smart to figure that out. And yet they did it 5,000 years before Christ. That's amazing to think about. People were not stupid back then. They just lacked the technology that we have. And sometimes we tend to think of ourselves as being intellectually superior, but we're not. We're not. So, anyway. Yes?
Is Ishmael in the Quran? Do the Middle Eastern people believe they descended from Ishmael?
Now, yeah, whether or not he's in the Quran, I can't answer that definitively. I suspect that he is. I don't know. Matter of fact, I think that he is, and I'll tell you why. The question is this. Is Ishmael in the Quran? Okay, I don't know that for a fact because I've never read the Quran. I really should. I was reading an article the other day about why Christians should read the Quran. It was a fascinating article, but it was not a pro-Islam article. It basically was saying, you know, if you really think that this is this way, you really need to read this to see what it says for yourself. And maybe I should. But let's read the next story, because the answer is they do say things remarkably different because of the next story. Okay? Great question, though. Okay, let's get to the next story now. Anything else? Yes?
Hagar is one of his wives.
Yes.
Why is it written that she's a slave?
Okay, because she was. You could do that. You could marry. Well, okay, it's kind of complicated, but I'll try to make it as. She technically is a concubine. Okay, now a concubine has every bit the legal rights in order to get rid of her, he has to divorce her. I mean, he can't just say, get out of here, you're, you know, my chattel property and get the heck out of here. He can't do that. He, in that culture, concubines had certain legal rights. And by doing what Sarah did, by substituting her handmaiden, who was a slave, in this process, which was culturally acceptable and understood, we have plenty of other examples from the ancient Near East where people did this. Hey, she's a concubine. She's got all sorts of rights. She has all kinds of rights. Now, the fact of the matter is that they likely picked her up when they were in Egypt. Slavery is an ugly thing that has been practiced by all human beings in all cultures and all times. Sometimes people say, well, you know, let's just, how do you regulate it? How do you control it? This sort of stuff. Like, for example, what most people don't realize is that at the time of Jesus, in the Roman world, half the population of the Roman Empire were slaves. Of all sorts of ethnicities, of all sorts of, in various types and shapes and forms. They weren't necessarily, I mean, like we understand slavery in the United States was. It's not an equivalent thing, but there was some idea of ownership, the same as in the ancient Near East. But within the Old Testament, you'll see certain regulations that say you can do this, but you can't do this. You can do this, but you can't do this. But once Abraham consummated this relationship, she's a concubine. Now, the fact is that she also was a slave, but they're really trying to hammer this home because there's some, what I think, I don't want to read too much into it, but I think there's some pointing out that there's some inequity that's going on here, that Hagar is getting the short end of the stick. And God recognizes that, and God's trying to compensate for that. Because she really is. I mean, it's kind of hard to deny it. Now, she's kind of being snot. I mean, as I said, whatever you do, don't go be sassy. Sassy's not a good thing. Sassy is not your best sort of line of defense. Particularly when you are in the right, it doesn't help to be sassy. If you're in the right, just say, you know, I'll let everything run its course. But, you know, being sassy didn't help her. But yes, it does say that, but she actually had more rights. And we'll hopefully get to the kind of the where I'm going with a lot of this in a second. Okay.
If you're interested, the Quran does mention the same story.
Yes.
Well, I don't know. But they don't mention Ishmael's name. They just say that this is firstborn in the descent.
Yes.
They will assume it's Ishmael.
Correct. Yeah, that's exactly correct. That's kind of, yeah. They say that they don't mention Isaac or Ishmael by name. They say his firstborn. And so they assume that what happens next happens to Ishmael, not to Isaac. So, a little bit of confusion there. Okay, let's actually look at who feels like reading. Anybody feel like reading? All right, go for it, Keith. The one verse.
These things God tested Abraham.
Oh my!
And said to him, Abraham.
Remember Bob Dylan? God said to Abraham, "Kill me a son." And says Abraham, "Says, what do you want this killing to be done?" He looked out on the set and said, "You don't listen to Bob Dylan, do you? I just got these blank stares." It's Highway 61 Revisited is the name of the song. The very Highway 61 that goes through White Bear Lake, Minnesota. So anyway, there you go. Read on. Also, not terribly far from your hometown.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that same Highway 61 goes right far from your hometown. Read.
He said, "Here I am." He said, "Take your son, your only son."
Ooh, that's kind of crazy.
"Whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah."
Moriah.
Moriah, that would be a different story.
That would be a different story altogether.
"And offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you."
Yikes.
"So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. And he cut wood for the burnt offering, and arose, and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. And then Abraham said to his young men, 'Stay here with the donkey, and I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you.' And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took his knife, he took his hand and the fire and the knife. So they went, both of them together. And Isaac said to his father, Abraham, 'My father.' And he said, 'Here I am, my son.' And he said, 'Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?' Abraham said, 'God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son.' So they went, both of them together."
Okay. Now, may I say to you, this requires an immense amount of faith. An immense amount of faith. I have to take you back to a time long ago and far away, before the interweb. Now, I'm not casting any aspersions upon any of us in this room, Becky, you and I, because we would not do such things. But it is interesting how many pastors' sermons, or you, Daryl, either, that get passed along on the internet. Pardon? Oh, gosh. Holy cow. I was at a funeral one time, and the pastor said about two sentences about the guy and then went into this internet sermon and then at the end said two sentences about the guy. And I was just dumbfounded. Just dumbfounded. Well, before the internet, we had other ways to get our stuff. We had photocopying, mimeograph stuff, and told stories. But one of the stories that was told back then to illustrate faith, because we were simply trying to get illustrations for their sermons and such like that, was this guy that used to tightrope walk across Niagara Falls. And as he would do this, he would try to do even greater feats of strength. And one thing that he would do is he would push a barrel across on the tightrope. You've heard this one, haven't you, dear? Absolutely, of course you have. All of you, there, yeah. Anyway, so they tightrope, and so finally he would draw crowds and people. And one day he said, "How many of you believe that I can tightrope walk across Niagara Falls?" And they all said, "Oh, we do, yay! How many of you think that I can do that while I push this barrel across?" "Oh, yeah, absolutely." He said, "Well, how about you, sir? Do you think you can?" "Oh, yeah, I've seen you do it 20 times. It's amazing. Yeah. Do you think I can do it?" "Well, yes, of course I think you can do it." "Okay, get in the barrel." Faith is getting in the barrel. And this is faith here. Faith is saying, not just taking the sacrifice with him, who's holding the fire and holding the lumber and holding the knife, but faith is saying, "God will provide." That's the definition of faith. That's an unbelievable kind of faith, to take God at his word when something is as terrifying as that. And I can't think of a thing more terrifying than this. This is about one of the most unreasonable asks I could ever imagine. Just being honest. I can't imagine this. Even knowing the end of the story, even knowing I get to know how the story ends, I still have a hard time putting my head around this. This is a hard, hard ask. Hard ask. Think about it. But faith is being able to say, "Son, God will provide." Read on.
"When they came to the place of which God had told them, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand, took the knife to slaughter his son."
Okay, now. His son is how old? It doesn't say, does it? 12, 13, 14, something like that. And how old's he? 100 plus, something like that. Within Judaism, this is not called the binding of Isaac. Typically, this story is called the binding of Isaac, where Isaac is bound and put on the altar. Within Judaism, this is called the submission of Isaac. The submission of Isaac. Because Isaac submits to this. Kind of a different perspective, isn't it? That Isaac submits to what his father is doing. Isaac also has a different sort of faith even, an even more intense faith. We don't hear much about Isaac's faith. We really don't. When we get to Isaac, it's not about Isaac at all. The story of Isaac is not about Isaac. The story about Isaac is about who? Rebecca. The story of Isaac is the story of Rebecca, not the story of Isaac. I mean, she's an incredible woman. I mean, she's an amazing woman. Isaac's kind of a flat character. Except here. Here we see him submit to his father, submit to God's plan. Now, we do not have the Ten Commandments yet at this point. But we do have an amazing, amazing illustration here of the benefits that come from the Ten Commandments, and specifically honoring your parents. This is a tough one for us, isn't it? What are some of the objections to honoring our parents? I was going to say, did everybody in this room have perfect parents, for crying out loud? They're abusive. Not they are, but parents can be abusive. That's right. That's one thing. Anything else?
They're human. They make mistakes.
They're human. Not to hear the sergeant tell it. Okay, they're human. They make mistakes. Anything else?
Kids strive for independence.
Kids strive for independence. They do. It's a... The technical term is self-differentiation. When your children were young, they were literally a part of you. They were inside of you. They're that kind of absolute necessity to have you for nurture. When they are born, they still are very needy of you and their closeness. I mean, nursing and so forth, it's necessary, that kind of closeness. One of my favorite things to do, and it tells you what a rat I am, is that when kids come, you know, go into a house and visit Pat, and there's little kids, they come hiding right behind mom. Boom, you know, they get behind mom and they kind of peek out behind mom. Kids like you though, Becky. The kids like you here. They really do. They really like Becky, and Becky knows all of them by name. It's amazing. But in any case, then the more we differentiate ourselves, there's this process of self-differentiation. Till there comes the point that says, I don't want to be like that for anything. For love nor money do I want to be like that. Then comes the great day. The great day. It is the great day. It's the great day depending upon what end you're on. There was the great day that came in my life when I opened my mouth and out fell my father. And it was such an embarrassing day. It was horrible. But you know what's greater now? Is when I see my sons open their mouths and see me fall out. That's positively diabolical, isn't it? Isn't it wonderful? But there's this process of self-differentiation. Yes, that's another thing, that we're striving for independence. Any other things? We don't want to be like them. We say that. And yet, God promises us a reward if we honor our parents. Amazing thing. Amazing thing. So, that's a tough one. It's tough to get our head around, particularly if there's been abuse. I mean, that's a really hard thing. I mean, as I said, trying to talk to someone who's been through abuse in a situation like this. But apparently there's not been abuse here, because what does it say about Abraham's relationship with Isaac? It says, your only son, not really, but I mean, he treats him that way, your son who you love. There's not that. There's this tenderness, there's this waiting, there's this fulfillment of the promise, there is this sense of, I've been waiting and waiting and waiting, and now this comes. Read on.
But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. He said, Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in the thicket by the horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the name of that place, The Lord Will Provide. As it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord it shall be provided.
Okay, we'll stop there for a second. God provides the sacrifice. God sees that Abraham has faith. God sees, more importantly, that Isaac has faith. I mean, you see, there is this incredible faith here. And again, we say to ourselves, what was up with all this? It's kind of crazy, even. And yet, we see this great exchange that God provides a sacrifice on our behalf. I don't want to get all Christological on you, but it does seem like this would be an appropriate time and place to do that.
No foreshadowing here.
Yeah, no foreshadowing here whatsoever. Absolutely. What we have here is almost spelling things out. It's like sort of like the cartoon with the bubble that says, they're in here, they're hiding in here, you know, like that. Back to your question. One of the challenges of Islam is that it's significantly after the fact. And I think it's important for us to be reminded of that, that Islam is significantly after the fact. And what I mean by this is as follows. Okay. events of the Old Testament take place somewhere between 2150 BC, depending upon where you put the start of Abraham. It might be as recent as 1850 BC, up to 400 BC. How it actually gets written down, we don't know. We do know that somewhere around 200 BC, everything's written down that's written down because it gets translated into Greek in Egypt and becomes what's called the Septuagint, okay? Now, this is the Bible that's used by Christians. When they, the Jewish people who are followers of Jesus, they use this Greek Bible. Now, the people who are the holier than thou, you know, it's sort of like the, do I use the NIV or do I use the English Standard Version? You know, it's kind of one of those sort of deals. It's not too much different, really. It's not. Because, you know, you could, I'm serious, this is true. If you're sniffing around a little bit, you can tell a lot about a person's background by what Bible translation they use. You really can. I can tell an amazing amount about a person by their background, by which translation of the Bible they use. It's true. You could do that back then. But somewhere about 90 AD, the Hebrew Bible was boom, lock, stop, barrel. This is the Hebrew Bible, period. This is the one we're going to use. Okay? It's complete. I'm going to turn this thing off. It's the other one, Rhonda. Chucklehead number one. Imagine that. He actually breaks radio silence. I think he's sending a picture of my... must need money. No, all of my children know better than that. All of them do. I've trained them on that one. I've pretended to be poor in their presence, so they think that there's no point in asking because he doesn't have any. But little do they know. Islam doesn't come around until about 600-700 years after that. And after Christianity is fairly well developed, and after Christianity and Judaism are fairly common in the part of the world where Islam rises. So you can see that there's a lot of heavy borrowing going on. You know, again, I've never read the book, probably should, but there is an immense amount of heavy borrowing that goes on and not necessarily accurate stuff that's going on. So the answer is yes, but I'm not all that convinced that Ishmael is the direct descendant or, you know, is a direct lineage to the Arabs today and Ishmael. I'm not all that convinced about that. Now, they think so. They'll tell you so. Arabs, mind you. And you know that there's a huge difference, but not all Muslims are Arabs. Are we clear on that? Yeah, not all Muslims are Arabs. As a matter of fact, the most populous Muslim nation in the world is, anybody know? No. No. Indonesia. What's the fourth most populous nation in the world? But it is almost everybody in Indonesia is Muslim. It is easily the most populous Muslim nation in the world by a long shot. Pakistan would be right up there behind it. So,
yeah.
Well, the story of Hagar and a well, there's a ceremony in the Hajj at Mecca.
Yeah.
Recounts a certain cycle. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but it links back to this.
Sure, of course, it probably does. Yeah, but this stuff's already there and already clearly independent of anything related to Ishmael.
But my favorite Christmas objection,
yes,
that Becky knows about, are these horrible Christmas cards that show Bethlehem,
yes,
with minarets and prayer towers and domes.
Yes.
And they're leading away on a donkey with Mary.
No minarets there at the time.
Is a... evidently a shepherd with a shepherd's crook. I've seen thousands of those. They must be copied at the different greeting cards.
Well, yeah. In terms of architecture, no, minarets obviously wouldn't come until the Islamic period, and domes would not come until it was a Roman art feature, but it was about 300-400 years later. Yeah. So yes. In any case, your objection is well raised. Okay, back to this. We'll read on. Oh yes, yes you may.
When Abraham heard the angel,
yes.
Did Isaac also hear?
Gosh, one hopes so. Yeah. He'd say, "Wow, what a relief that is." There's nothing there that says it either way, but you can see that there he becomes unbound and has all sorts of he gets free from it. So, read on. Oh, Dwayne's got one. Now you come up with a question.
Okay, so what's the significance when God says to Abraham, take your son,
yes.
Your only son?
Yes.
We had two sons.
We do know he had two sons. Well, the probable significance, obviously, it doesn't say here. I think the emphasis here is the son of promise, the son that I promised you. This is my handiwork. That was your handiwork. Kind of going to the question about the slave girl. Says, that was your doing. I want to deal with my doing here. This is the stuff. This is my handiwork.
So in that sense, God is essentially saying Ishmael doesn't exist.
He's not saying Ishmael doesn't exist. What he's saying is that Ishmael, and this is going to come out. We need to read the book of, well, hopefully we'll get to this next week when we get to Galatians, that there's two children. One's the child, it says slave girl again in Galatians, and one's the child of promise. One is the child of our own doing, this is how you do things, and the other one is this is how I do things. I'm in the miracle business.
Okay. I mean, we did just hear God say...
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, there's no question about it. Absolutely. God understands. Yes, Dan.
In chapter 22, verse 11...
Mm-hmm.
But the angel of the Lord, mm-hmm. as you say, only one angel is really named. This one is just the angel. But, you know, the language structure is kind of like if you're telling, a joke, as you're prone to do sometimes. And so the man says, well, wait a minute, where did this man come from? In the joke, everybody would know who he was. He's been built up.
Yes.
Was an angel attending this stamp of the importance of discipline and obedience?
The angel, of course, again, the word angel, angelos, is messenger. Angelos in Greek, and then I forget what it is in Hebrew. It's slipped my mind. Getting old. But in any case, the angel here is simply giving a message from God. It's a message of the Lord, and that's important. He's saying, Abraham, enough. This is how God is communicating to Abraham, saying, I understand, I get it, we don't need to go any further. Okay? There is some emphasis on the last syllable. Okay? Read on.
The angel of the Lord...
See, I'm used to interrupting. Now all these other people are interrupting. Now, boy, you got a tough kid. Read on.
The angel of the Lord called Abraham the second time from heaven and said... By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply your offspring as stars of the heavens and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies.
Remember that? What I said about the gate of your enemies? Your offspring will possess the gate of your enemies. Most important thing you could have. Read on.
And in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed.
There you go.
Because you have obeyed my voice.
There you go.
So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba. And Abraham lived at Beersheba.
Okay, well, this next little passage here is quite interesting.
Got some tough names, but I'm sure you're right.
Now, after these things, it was told to Abraham, behold, Milcah, who has borne children to your brother Nahor, Uz, his firstborn, Buz, naturally, his brother.
Oh, Uz and Buzz are only to be topped by Eldad and Medad. I love Eldad and Medad more than I love Uz and Buzz. But Uz and Buzz are pretty. I mean, is that, what else would you name your kids? Uz and Buzz. Read on. What's the daughter's name? Oh, we're going to. Oh, you don't want to know what the daughter's name is because we're going to find out in a little bit. Read on.
Well, the father of Aram. I almost said cheesehead.
Cheesehead. No, this man is not, a Wisconsin Green Bay Packer fan.
Chesed. Hazo. Phildash.
They're not the market of either.
And Bethuel. Bethuel, father, Rebecca.
Now, notice how that's set off there? In parentheses.
Now, things to come.
Yeah, precisely. Right now, you should be terrified. Because these two individuals that you have just come up with are going to play an interesting role, Bethuel and Rebecca. But more importantly, read on.
These eight Milcah bore to Nahor, Abram's brother. Moreover, his concubine,
Porcupine,
whose name was
bore
Tiba, Gaham, Tahash, and Macha.
Okay, there you go. All right, very well done. There are 12 of them there, by the way. How odd is that? Plus one woman being mentioned. How odd is that? That's kind of curious there. The woman being mentioned is Rebecca. Who's not mentioned is Rebecca's brother.
Laban.
Rebecca's probably one of the most powerful characters in the Bible. I really think that she's an amazing, amazing person. But her brother is probably one of the most shifty characters in the Bible. This is a family you did not want to grow up in, okay? You just didn't. And dad just sort of sitting there. Well, we've got that all done. Okay, so there we have that little situation. Now we want to move on a little bit, okay? Let's move on. And you're doing a great job. Keep going. We're going to we'll hit it up here. This is a great story right here. Okay.
Sarah lived 127 years.
That's a long time. So basically, she lived another 38 years after she bore Isaac. Okay? It's important to know. Okay?
These were the years of the life of Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
And Sarah died at Kiriath Arba.
That's it.
That is Hebron.
Yeah.
In the land of Canaan.
Mm-hmm.
And Abraham went to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her.
Yes.
And Abraham rose up from before his dead,
mm-hmm.
and said to the Hittites,
Hittite.
I am a sojourner and a foreigner among you. Give me property among you for a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. The Hittites answered Abraham, Hear us, my lord. You are a prince of God among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will withhold from you his tomb to hinder you from burying your dead. Abraham rose and bowed to the Hittites, people of the land. And he said to them, If you are willing that I should bury my dead out of sight, hear me and entreat me, Ephron the son of Zohar,
mm-hmm.
that he may give me the cave of Machpelah,
mm-hmm.
which he owns. It is at the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence as property for my burial.
Mm-hmm.
Now Ephron was sitting among the Hittites, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham, in hearing of the Hittites, of all who went in the gate of his city. No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the sight of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead. Then Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron, in hearing of the people of the land, But if you will, hear me. I give the price of the field accepted from me, that I may bury my dead there. Ephraim answered Abraham, My lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver? What is that between you and me? Bury your dead. Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver that he had named in the hearings of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver according to the weights current among merchants. So the field of Ephron in Machpelah, which was to the east of Mamre, the field with the cave that was in it and all the trees that were in the field throughout its whole area was made over to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the Hittites.
before all who went in at the gate of his city.
There you go, that's that gate again.
After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, east of Mamre, that is Hebron, the land of Canaan. This field and the cave that is in it were made over to Abraham as property for burying by the Hittites.
What's going on here?
Negotiation.
No, oh my goodness gracious sakes alive, like you would not believe. Now, stereotyping is a horrible thing. Let's just be honest. No one likes to be stereotyped or anything like that. And how are Middle Easterners typically stereotyped?
Being, well, bargainers.
As hagglers, bargainers, and so forth. And again, it's not a good thing to do this, but if any of you have ever been to the Middle East or the Holy Lands, and you go into a marketplace and you pay full price for anything that's there, you've got dumb written on your forehead, okay? Because they expect you to bargain. And that's exactly what's going on here. Oh, pretty much, as I said. Come on, the idea is this is part of the deal, as I said. That's what they do. They enjoy this. Some people don't. I cannot stand one price car pricing. Who came up with this sin? I like to go in there and, you know, look the guy in the eye and look at him and say this: make me buy it today. Make me buy it today. And then the game's on. It's great fun. I enjoy that. Absolutely. I learned that from my dad. Holy cow. Was listening to him, watching him do that. He was a past master at this stuff. Of course, then again, he spent 39 months in the Middle East too, so he knew what was going on there. So in any case, we have that. But also there's another thing going on here that we may not notice. And that's the whole Middle Eastern thing about saving face. Saving face. One of the things that we don't understand as Westerners in working today in the Middle East, and people say, well, how come so-and-so is not supporting us, you know, because of the terrorist things that are going on here? And how come so-and-so is, you know, how come these people these people, I always love that phrase, how come they're not, you know, standing up for and opposing these things? If they're so peaceful, you don't get the culture. The culture is you save face among each other. Believe me, you need to understand that most folks from the Middle East who have come to this country years and years ago came because they do not want to be oppressed and they don't want to live in the oppression that was over there. They don't want any part of it. But by the same token, you see here, what are they saying? You know, what's this piece of land? This land is nothing between you and me. You're such a prince. Oh, no, no. I wouldn't think of cheating you out of it. Oh, no. I'll pay you the full price. I wouldn't think of charging you the full price. When are we going to get to the price, for crying out loud? Where's the price? What is this actually going to cost? When do we stop the saving face? When do we stop the negotiations? And when do we get to the price? There does come a point. And that's an important thing in the Middle East, is this whole notion of the importance of saving face. That you don't want someone to come across as getting a bad deal. I mean, you don't want them to come across a bad deal, because you're not going to get a good deal the next time. Next time you will get a bad deal. They'll make sure of it if you make them look bad. And so that's what's going on here. Yes, Dan.
Okay, the places again. I know you liked
Machpelah.
Yeah. Where was Abraham at this time?
Not very far from there, because Hebron, he's in Beersheba, which isn't there. Hebron is at the foothills, Beersheba's at the foothills, Hebron's up in the hills a little bit.
So she was not with him when she died, or that is just the burial?
No, that's just the burial place. Hebron's a kind of a metropolitan area, or an inhabited area.
No, it says she died at Kiriath Arba.
Which is Hebron.
Yeah.
Same place.
As Beersheba?
No, Beersheba's down the hill a little bit.
Okay.
What is the tradition on how quickly they bury?
They bury in 24 hours, and guess what? You can go to this day. Now, Hebron is in the Palestinian part of modern-day Israel, but they do have a Jewish shrine there, which is the cave at Machpelah. You can go there if you so desire. To this day. The traditional burial place of this. Yeah. It's there. Now, whether it's the actual place or not, we don't know. You know why we don't know where the actual place is? Her name was Helen. Seriously, her name was Helen, and she was the mother of Constantine, Saint Helen. She was the one that kind of encouraged her son to become a Christian. And she decided that she was going to take a trip to the Holy Land, and she kept asking, well, where is this? And they look around and say, you know anything about the Church of the Holy Sepulchre? No. Oh, it's over there. Where is this? Church of the Nev- isn't that in Bethlehem? Oh, it's over there. So they had to come up with a place to put this stuff. There weren't shrines over these things before the 4th century A.D. At the 4th century A.D., they went crazy putting up shrines all over the place because of St. Helen, because she went through there looking for this, that, and the other thing and wanted to know where it was because her baby was the emperor of the Roman Empire that controlled that area. Okay, let's finally read the last part here because we want to get to that. Okay. We're going to skip to 25. Anybody feel like chapter 25? You're doing a great job, Keith. Keep going.
Chapter 25?
Yes. No, that's a different story. That's a different narrative. That's not Abraham's narrative. That's the narrative of Isaac. Actually, it's the narrative of Rebekah. Yeah, as I said, one of the crazy things about we have this biographical overlap. That's not his story. That's her story. And again, it's not Isaac's story. It's Rebekah's story. Keep going.
Abraham took another wife whose name...
The nerve of this guy for crying out loud.
He's only 100.
He's 137.
Keturah. She bore him Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shuah. Jokshan fathered Sheba and Dedan. Mm-hmm. The sons of Dedan were Ashpurim, Letshurim, and Uminim. The sons of Midian were Medan. Mm-hmm.
Is it Midian? Midian, it's Midian, you got it.
Were Epher, Hanak, Abida, mm-hmm. and Eldah. Mm-hmm. All of these were children of Keturah. Abraham gave all he had to Isaac, but to the sons of the concubines, Abraham gave gifts, and while he was still living, he sent them away from his son Isaac eastward to the east country.
That's where you go if you're going eastward. Makes sense to me.
These are the days of the years of Abraham's life, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. Isaac and Ishmael, his sons, buried him.
75 and 89.
Of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar, the Hittite, east of Mamre, the field that Abraham purchased from the Hittites. There Abraham was buried with Sarah, his wife. Mm-hmm. After the death of Abraham, God blessed Isaac, his son, and Isaac settled at Beer Lahai-Roi.
Another place you get beers.
Any case, in any case, what we see here is he has a third wife. Now, the interesting thing about this third wife is we don't know anything about her. Nothing. See, we know that Sarah was a part of his clan, right? His tribe, his family. Okay? We know that Hagar was an Egyptian. It doesn't say anything about her. Now, this is where the rabbis enter into. Because, you know, anytime there's a question about something or something that's omitted, somebody has to fill in the blanks, right? And so the rabbis are great for filling in the blanks, and they filled in blanks right and left. Some rabbis say that Hagar and Keturah are one and the same, that Hagar are the same person. It's not likely, believe me, it's not likely, because there's a 51-year gap between the childbearing of Hagar the first time and the childbearing of Hagar the second time, if this is in fact Hagar. But it's probably not Hagar. Some suggest that some rabbis suggested that Abraham actually divorced Hagar and divorces Keturah. I mean that so that this is what happens. You know, this has been suggested by a whole line of rabbinic thinking. Then there are others that suggest that that's not what happened. That Hagar dies before he marries Keturah, so that way he's not a polygamist again. Because he's trying to get out of the sort of the deal that Sarah made from, so he's not a polygamist. But again, nowhere does it say any of this sort of stuff. Then some rabbi came up with this clever idea. I thought this was kind of an interesting idea. He says, he's got three wives. How many sons did Noah have? What have they got to do anything? Well, you've got a son, you got a daughter from the sons of Shem, which would be Sarah. You've got a daughter from the sons of Ham, which would be Hagar. Well, who's left? Jephthah. And so that this rabbi suggested that somehow she was a part of the Jephthatic peoples, which would be people like us, okay, the European types. Then some people, and I thought, well, hey, you could spiritualize this. You've got one that represents Judaism, one that represents Islam, and one that represents Christianity. Wouldn't that be cute and clever? The only problem is this, is what we're going to learn next week about Abraham and the New Testament. But it is an interesting speculation because we don't know who these people are. We do know one thing about Keturah, is Keturah means incense. And oddly enough, four of these people that are mentioned, four of the six people mentioned, are associated with the regions in Western Arabia about the spice and incense route and the trade that goes on there. So I'm more of the opinion that the Arabs don't come from Ishmael, but they come from Keturah, probably. I don't know that for a fact, can't prove it, but it makes more sense because if you look at these ancient peoples, particularly these four, they're all in Western Arabia and they all have association with the incense route where they traded this incense, which was very expensive stuff and really an important commodity back then, and her name meant incense. So, there you go. So he had three wives. Yes.
Verse 6 seems to tell us that Abraham had more than just these three wives.
Well, it says his two concubines, okay? Now, so here's how you it says concubines, plural. It doesn't say how many. Here you can get off the hook by saying it's just two because Hagar technically was a porcupine and Keturah was technically a porcupine, and you could say it like that, all right? But it's possible that he had more. He was rich. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
This is sort of tough.
That's okay.
But when we're reading here, these are very Arab-sounding names to me.
They're Semitic names.
And yes. We get from Bernard, we have Matthew, Mark, Luke, John.
They're Greek.
They're Greek.
Yes.
Well, they're Greek influence. Actually, Matthew is a Hebrew name. John is also a Hebrew name, but they have a Greek influence. And Jesus is a Hellenized or Greek form of a Hebrew name, Joshua. So yes, what's happened is you've got the Semitic. Now, here's the thing. The Hebrew language and the Arabic language are very similar. Like, for example, salam is how you greet an Arab, and shalom is how you greet a Jew. Same word. Means peace. Salam, salam aleikum, or shalom. Either one.
So David, is David's name?
David's name is Semitic. Yep, it's Semitic, yes. David is that. Yes.
Now this version doesn't talk about Ishmael the way other versions do. Mm-hmm. The name's a wild donkey of a man.
Well, actually, it says something else.
I rather like the way it said it in the Revised Standard.
Grace would never get along with you.
That's chapter 16. It says
it's coming.
It's in 16. It's there.
Which, not to generalize, but in the Middle East, you kind of they don't seem to get along with each other in the different countries. Or
Okay, just to kind of let you know, what's happening is this, and that's a good point, but I want you to understand that contextually you might be projecting something here, because where they're not going to get along is this. A little bit later on in this book, actually a lot later on in this book, you have this story about a guy named Joseph. Okay? Joseph is the what? He is the great-grandson of Abraham, right? And what happens to Joseph? He gets sold. And who are the agents of this? No. His brothers are the profiteers from this. The agents of this are Ishmaelites and Midianites who happen to be hanging out together. Now, they're not. It just says Ishmaelites and Midianites, but you do the math. Do you know who your cousins are? Do you know who any of your second cousins? In my last congregation, I had a third cousin who was a member of the congregation. And it was fun having my children and his children, well, his sister's children come together. We had pictures of fourth cousins together. It was kind of neat. You do the math about how close these people are, and you're talking about people who are close-knit. You mean to tell me these Midianites and these Ishmaelites didn't know who this kid was that they were profiting from by selling him into Egypt? I don't think so. I think they knew exactly who he was, and they were very glad to do what they were doing. In addition to the profit they were making, they kind of got to stick it. Because, I mean, sometimes, you know how there's certain sides of the family that you think, oh, they're putting on airs. They're kind of, they're the uptown ones. You know, they think they're hoity-toity. You know, their dad Abraham's got all kinds of money. He was born into all that money, that Isaac. Isaac's a granddad. He was born, and Jacob, he got even richer, and he cheated Laban out of all that money. You know how they got their money. And so when you got a family situation like that, those kind of family members, those kind of cousins are more than willing to help out. Yes. You see, you didn't see those connections coming because we just think, but see, you don't have to go very far to see where he is set against everybody, because you see what that already happening in the story of Joseph.